The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
a beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan! Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
Control the money, and it doesn't matter who writes the laws. That's a paraphrase of a quote attributed to Meyer Rothschild, the 18th century patriarch of the famous banking dynasty. Our guest is a writer, film producer, who researches diverse topics such as ancient Earth history, the United Nations, and the Federal Reserve System in international banking. He's the president of American Media, and perhaps best known as the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve, a book recommended by Dr. Ron Paul, among other people. It is our honor and pleasure to welcome to Future Congress on Emerging Threats and Challenges, G. Edward Griffin. Ed, it is truly an honor to meet you.
Well, thanks a lot, Derek. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you're speaking on the Creature from Jekyll Island at the conference here this weekend, but referring back to the quote, which again attributed to Meyer Rothschild, what does that mean? If you control the money, it doesn't really matter who writes the laws.
Well, it's an interesting question because at first I thought it was self-evident, but it really isn't when you analyze it, is it?
Well, to most of us who are not educated in economics.
Yeah, because most of us, until we get into the reality of politics and economics, we think that those are two separate worlds, money and politics.
Sure.
But in fact, the engine that drives politics is money. If you have enough money, you can buy politicians. That's the reality. So think about that for a minute. If you have not only enough money, but you have all the money, if you have the ability to create the money, if for some reason, which we can talk about later, you have been given the monopolistic power to create money on behalf of the nation, which is what our Federal Reserve System does, and what central banks in all the nations of the world now do, that is a tremendous political force, a political power. So when Rothschild said that you give me control of the nation's money and I will give you control of the nation's politicians is basically what he was saying. And it's a reality. We certainly can see it in the United States today.
So when the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, or as a result of law passed in 1913, what effect did that have on American politics and who controls it?
Well, the immediate effect wasn't very great because it was something, it's like a huge train, I suppose, a 100-car train. You just don't get up to speed right away. So it took a little while. Once they put the throttle forward on the engine and it went huff and puff, it took quite a while before the train started to move. But what it really meant in the long run is that the bankers, that's the best word you can use for them, although they're more than bankers, but they are the international financiers. They have interlocking connections with all the great international banks of the world. We're talking about that caliber. We're not talking about your local bank down the street, but we're talking about, you know, in those days it was Kuhn, Loeb & Company and the Rockefeller Bank, Chase Manhattan and so forth, the big banks that were interlocked with all the other big banks in the world. Were able to influence legislation. They actually drafted their own legislation, but they didn't want anybody to know that they had written the law, which is the reason they went to Jekyll Island to do the job. Jekyll Island, just for the sake of the record here, is a private island. At least in those days, it was privately owned by a small group of billionaires from New York, you know, J.P. Morgan and William Rockefeller and their business associates, and they decided that rather than write the law that was supposed to control the banks and regulate the banks on behalf of the American people and all of that, instead of doing that in Congress, they would do it on Jekyll Island at a very highly secret meeting. Nobody was allowed to know that they were going. They certainly weren't allowed to attend. There were no newspaper reporters. They denied that they went and all of those things. They did that because they did not want the world to know that the bill to control the banks was being written by the banks. It's a very simple strategy. Now we know, in retrospect, you can go back and open up the books and see all the records and the letters and the interviews that were given by these people in the ensuing years, and the record is clear. But at that time, they wanted to keep it very, very secret. So what does that mean? That means that the bankers formed a cartel. Prior to that time, the banks were in competition with each other, pretty much. But at the turn of the last century, that competition was diminishing. And we found that these large banks had come to the decision that many industrialists had come to in the United States, that the time of free enterprise competition must come to an end. You know, it was Rockefeller himself who's quoted as saying, "Competition is a sin." Of course, he acquired his great wealth and power through competition. But once he got to the top of the heap, he didn't want competition to exist anymore. And so the idea was to put an end to competition. And they do that either by destroying their competition or absorbing them into their empire. Or if they can't do that, if they're all too big, then they form a cartel and agree not to compete and share the market, sort of a shared monopoly. Mm-hmm. And that process was going on at all levels of industry and commerce in the United States at that time, and it certainly was going on also in banking. So having talked around the circle a little bit on that, we come back to your question, what happened on Jekyll Island, or what happened when they created the Federal Reserve? Mm-hmm. The thing that happened is that they created a banking cartel, and they made it look like it was a government agency, and they took control of America's money system. That's about as simple as you can summarize it. Those three things, profound steps, which means that from that point forward in history, that train would start to move faster and faster and faster. And it was just a question of time until it's a runaway train wreck like we see today. And there's practically no way to stop it because there's so much momentum. And because the people of America don't know the history, they don't know very much about banking. They don't even know much about money or what it should be. The gold-silver issue is very confusing and all of that. And most of all, though, the biggest problem is not the absence of information on the part of the voter. The biggest problem is that the politicians who have the ability to make any changes if they wanted to are totally in the pockets of the banks. So it's pretty naive to go to Washington today and expect any of those bought for politicians to make a change, because they're not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about where we are along this track in just a few moments, but just to a little more history for those of us who don't know how this came to be. You know, it's best to understand how we got where we are from understanding where we started. Who participated in the creation of this banking cartel at Jekyll Island?
Well, there were six rather prominent men, and I've got their names all listed in the book, but some of them are not known to the average person. But there are certain names that show up, not because of who they were as persons, but because of the institutions they represented. They were the presidents of the largest banks at the time. Mm-hmm. They represented the J.P. Morgan interests and the Rockefeller interests and Kuhn Loeb Company. And those three institutions were very closely aligned with the Rothschilds in Europe, England and France, and with the Warburgs in the Netherlands and Germany. And it was really an international, I like to use the word cabal, because that's basically what it was. It was a financial cabal. So even though we don't know the names of the individuals, you know, perhaps the best known one would be Senator Nelson Aldrich, because he is a historic figure. He was the chairman of the International Monetary Commission, which is the committee of Congress, which was given the job of writing the legislation that we now know as the Federal Reserve Act. And so Aldrich's name is familiar, but it's also important because he was a close business associate the Rockefellers. And in fact, he became eventually, he was the grandfather of Nelson Aldridge Rockefeller, who was our former vice president. His middle name, Aldridge, of course, comes from his famous grandfather, Senator Nelson Aldridge. So the people that created the Federal Reserve were the power structure, the financial power structure of America at the time. Significant because Americans were very concerned about the concentration of economic power in the hands of these very people. That was the motivation for having banking reform, as they called it, an act to reform banking. Well, today we should know that any time we hear the word reform attached to a bill in Congress, you better run and duck because it's just the opposite.
And hide your wallet.
Just the you hide your wallet and hide your wife, everything else. I mean, this is bad where these guys mislabel laws. And they were doing it even in those days. They called it a banking reform bill. And it was not anything of the kind. It was a grab for power. It was a grab for control of the American money supply. So, well, anyway, you see, the American people were concerned about this concentration of power in the hands of those institutions. And so that was the reason for the secrecy and why they had to go to Jekyll Island and do all of this dirty work.
Well, given the concern that the American public had back in the teens, 100 years ago, how did this cabal sell Congress and the American public on this so-called reform?
Very well.
Yeah, clearly.
They did a really good job. And the first thing they had to do was to conceal their authorship of it. We've already talked about that. Mm-hmm. And they did a brilliant job of that. It wasn't until quite a few years after the Federal Reserve was passed into law that they began to talk openly about their participation in it. Prior to that time, they said, oh, no, we didn't go to Jekyll Island. Jekyll Island, who? Me? No, not me. You know, what is this, conspiracy theory or something that, you know? They didn't use those words in those days, but it was the same idea. But then later they say, oh, yeah, well, we went. And as a matter of fact, they began to compete with each other for the title of being the most important person at the meeting after the Federal Reserve became accepted and revered as a great American institution. Then they began to vie for credit, and it was kind of humorous to see that happen. But it's all there in the literature. You can see the early newspaper reports in which they deny participating and so forth, and gradually as the next decade or two passed, first thing you know, they're giving interviews to newspaper reporters. One of them wrote an article in the Saturday Evening Post, and then later wrote a book. So, and then their biographers began to bring the information into the biographies of these famous men. So you can go to any well-stocked library today and just read exactly what they did. And probably, though, the most important person there technically was Paul Warburg. Warburg was a naturalized American citizen. He was born in Germany. He came from the Warburg banking consortium in the Netherlands and in Germany, very powerful banking dynasty. And he had the technical knowledge of how to create this scam, as really they call it a central bank. It's a nicer name. A central bank is, you look it up in any encyclopedia or economics textbook, and it'll be described more or less as just the government authorized banking system, something nebulous like that. But when you analyze it, you find out that they're private banks, and they do have the power of government because of the various influence they've been able to exert inside the governments, and so they get politicians to give them privileges and pass laws that transfer what would normally be the power of government into the hands of the private banking institutions. Mm-hmm. The Bank of England was the first such model. And so the Federal Reserve system was modeled consciously after the Bank of England. And the Bank of England is also a private bank, you see, even though most people think, oh, that's the British government, isn't it, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Same way they think that the Federal Reserve is, well, that's the American government, isn't it?
Yeah, a division of the U.S. Treasury. Yeah, I think most course, people assume that.
Yeah. And so anyway, that's I'm a little bit off the track. That's how it all came about. And so eventually it came out in the history books. And so today people either don't know about it. Oh, I know where I was going with that, but I'll come back to it. Either they don't know about it, or they think there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that's the way it should be, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? You know,
right.
So I started to say before that a couple of things that they did so well was that they concealed their authorship of it. And the second thing they did, and they did that very well too, is that they convinced the public that they were opposed to it.
I wasn't there. If I had been there, I would have been against it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I did it. Yeah.
The tactic is very well known in politics. It's being used every day in the United States today.
Mm-hmm.
People in high positions in corporations or in politics or military, it's done on the battlefield all the time. It's feigned opposition, pretended opposition,
mm-hmm.
or lead your own opposition. You know,
false flag.
False flags, anything.
Yeah.
If you can control your own opposition, you win. That's mm-hmm. the bottom line. And
mm-hmm.
so the bankers did that.
Mm-hmm.
They formed little groups around the country, and they promoted this, of course, as though it was a great thing from these little groups they formed. But then some of the key players gave speeches before bankers' associations and gave interviews to the national media saying, oh, I don't know about this bill. It looks pretty dangerous to me. You know, this is bad for America. It's going to be bad for business.
Oh.
And that got into the press, and, of course, the average person reading that in the newspaper. I can just hear it now. Some old guy reading the paper, he says, hey, Maud, listen to this. These bankers don't like the Federal Reserve Act very much. Must be pretty good, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So
okay.
That's another thing that they did.
Yep.
Then the third thing they did is that they strategized some very important concessions. The strongest opposition at the time came from the Senate, and William Jennings Bryan was the well-known, powerful leader of the populist movement, and he didn't think that the Federal Reserve was a good idea because it gave too much power to the banks to create money out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it was designed to do, of course. And Brian saw that. He said, this doesn't look right to me. He said, no, we don't want this. So Paul Warburg was the strategist on this one. And he told the boys, he said, look, let's revise the bill and let's put in some very strong restrictions that will prevent the Fed from doing the things that Brian is concerned about. And they said, Paul, what are you talking about? This is what we want. And Warburg said, I know this is what we want in the long run, but our objective now is to get the bill passed. We can fix it up later. And those were his words.
Mm-hmm.
Get the bill passed, and we can fix it up later. And indeed, they got the bill passed because Brian said, oh, well, with those provisions in them, I guess it's okay. They got the bill passed, and immediately they started to work now to amend the bill and mm-hmm. amend the bill and get rid of all those restrictions. And they were gone 100 years ago.
Yes.
No trouble. Now all the attention was off of the bill. People were worried about something else, and quietly they started to amend it. And this goes on, too, in politics every day in the United States.
Healthcare reform.
Everything you look at is that way.
Sure.
So, you know, when you're studying the origin of the Federal Reserve and its history, you're really studying a little microcosm of American politics.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of these strategies, which were used so brilliantly to bring a very rotten monetary system to this country, are being used to bring other rotten systems to this country, too.
Yeah. For people who don't understand, and I would count myself as basically among these, for the reading that I've done, and my bachelor's degree is in economics, Still, getting your mind around the Federal Reserve and what its net effect has been on the United States over the last 100 years is difficult. What has the Federal Reserve Bank meant to the average American, good or bad?
That's a good question. It's hard for me to imagine what the average American thinks about. And the only way I can approximate that is to think of myself a few years ago before I knew any of this. I guess I was average American in the terms of economic knowledge, monetary knowledge. And the answer to the question is I didn't think about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Federal Reserve, what's that?
Sure.
Who cares?
Yeah.
It's all taken care of, isn't it? It's for my own good, right? I go to the polls and I elect a good man that I vote for every couple of years. He takes care of it and it's all – where's my fun? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think the average person thinks much about it at all, except in some vague way that somehow it's for his own best interest and it's the people that are running it are good people mm-hmm. and they're going to take care of them.
Moderating the extremes of the economic
yes.
fluctuations back and forth.
Yes, taking care that we don't go too far in either direction, yeah. So it's a nice little fluffy image, but it's certainly far from reality.
Well, what is that reality, though?
Well, the reality is that the hen house is being guarded by the wolf.
Hmm.
That's the reality. The hen house, as it was built by the wolf, he's got installed a security system, and he patrols it, and he just picks off as many hens as he wants when he wants them, and that's it. That's the reality. The monetary system is controlled by the banks. That's the security system. To protect the American people from the avarice of the big banks, we have the banks taking care of that. So that's I can't think of a better analogy than that the hen house is being guarded by the banks.
Well, what role did the Federal Reserve System then play in the economic meltdown that began around 2008?
Well, our meltdown really, if you want to take a philosophical view, I think began in 1913 when the Federal Reserve System was created, because that's when the fundamentals were put into place that inevitably had to play out with the meltdown that we see now. Now, obviously, we didn't see the cracks. We didn't see the broken pieces. We didn't hear the anguished cries or anything until quite a bit later, but the mechanism was already in place and the wheels were gradually beginning to turn. But what really happened finally in 2008 when it became so clear that everybody could see it, and even it broke through into the national news media. I mean, the national news media, another part of this story, has always been very protective of the banking fraternity. They've always tried to polish stories or twist stories in such a way as to create the impression that all is well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got a little problem, but the bump is over. You know, the media has always been friendly to the banking fraternity to make sure that the public is not overly concerned about anything that's going on over there. It's all going to be fine. But in 2008, even that crumbled, and it became so obvious that there was some serious problems that the media finally allowed the average American to become concerned. Had the media not allowed that, I don't think, you know, the average American today would still be thinking all is well.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminds me of the bad old days in the 60s when everybody was joking about the Soviets, their, you know, the controlled media and the five-year plan and all that. The Soviets, everybody in America knew, and everybody in the Soviet Union also knew, even more so, that it was all propaganda. Every year, the government would come out and say, well, the economy is improving by 8% this year. And everybody in Russia knew that was a lie, but that was the official story. And if you didn't repeat it and say, yes, the economy is improving, mm-hmm. you would go to the gulag.
Yeah, very 1984.
Very yes. 1984.
Yeah.
Well, they could do that here. And in a certain way, they already are doing that here. You can become very you can fall into great disfavor if you let the people know that the emperor has no clothes.
Well, I've even seen that in your case, just doing some reading prior to the conference to get prepared. The fact that you have appeared many times with Glenn Beck on his Fox News program mm-hmm. Has made you a target of many in the left within the media and the so-called blogosphere.
Yes.
Who, you know, you and I guess I, by extension, are foil hat-wearing loons for questioning the official line.
Right.
The Federal Reserve Bank as a private entity then, and I guess that's important to understand, that it is a private corporation and not the government, not a government entity, quasi-government, I suppose, because the president appoints the chairman. Ben Bernanke was appointed by the president. How does this does the Federal Reserve Bank have a profit motive in its operations, and how does that affect what it does?
Yeah, this is a very important issue. You're correct in saying it's a quasi private corporation because it does have that one feature in particular where the president can appoint the chairman of the board. But where does he get the name to appoint the chairman of the board?
Oh.
Does it come out of his own personal address book? Of course not.
Hmm.
The president, you look at the list of the chairmen of the Federal Reserve System that have been appointed since 1913 when the thing started, I would bet a big pitcher of beer that none of the presidents ever knew the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board that they appointed before the time of appointment. Never met them. Probably didn't even know who in the heck they were. So where did they get the idea that they were going to appoint this person? And obviously, when you think about it, whether the names are suggested to them,
mm-hmm.
or more powerfully than that, they're told who to appoint. Who can tell the president who to appoint to any position? Well, the donors to his campaign, the people that run the political party that nominated him to the presidency, the ones that run the great media enterprises that can make sure that they can throw the public vote in their favor or against them, those are the ones who strike deals with the president before he's elected. They said, well, you know, Derek, we have our little differences of opinion, but we like you. Basically, we think you and I are on the same page. And you know, I can throw the election in your favor if I wish. And so I'm going to support you. And all I ask in return is that when it comes time to make an appointment to the Federal Reserve Board or to the Supreme Court or to the CIA or the Defense Department or a few unimportant things like that, would you consider the list I would submit?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, of course, I'd be happy to. I'm sure those would be fine gentlemen anyway. That's how it works. And so the reality, as opposed to this mythological thing, is that the president does not appoint the chairman of the Federal Reserve System. But the Federal Reserve System appoints the president.
Oh, okay.
You get it?
Yeah.
See, it's a complete reverse of this image that people have.
So it's not insignificant. It's rather important to note that the Wall Street campaign donations for Barack Obama were much larger than they were for John McCain.
Yes, it's important. It's very important.
Okay.
Without the Wall Street support, Mr. Obama would not have been elected, you see. So this is part of that reality game that most Americans have not ever played. They just don't know that there is such a game. So now we come back to the question, well, what is the Federal Reserve System, a corporation, and is it private? It is quasi-public. But the important thing is not whether it's a corporation or whether it's privately owned or any of that. Because in England, for example, it's a different structure. In France, it's a slightly different structure. In Belgium and so forth. But they're all central banks. The important thing is not who owns the stock, but who controls it.
Mm-hmm.
And stock ownership is not the means of controlling the Federal Reserve System, because the holders of the stock in the Federal Reserve are the banks themselves, and they cannot vote it. It's a non-voting stock. So what's this business of ownership? It means nothing.
Hmm.
See? If you really own something, you should be able to sell it. Banks cannot sell their stocks. So they don't own anything. It's just window dressing, you see. So, well, it's a corporation. It's owned by the banks. And the average person said, oh, isn't that nice? Then that's just everything is taken care of. We don't have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always back to this reality versus myth situation. And we live, unfortunately, in a mythological political world. And, of course, my job and your job, I presume, is we have to clear away that smokescreen and that myth.
And get back to operating in a reality-based environment.
Bring people to reality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that one of the functions of the Federal Reserve Bank and presumably central banks all over the planet is creating money out of nothing. How does that happen and how does that affect me?
It is true they create money out of nothing. If you wanted to get into a real technical debate, you could say, well, they don't really create it out of nothing, but they back it by debt. Well, debt is not really nothing. Let's say I had the ability to create money at will. If I wrote on here $1,000 and signed my name to it, and because of my political connections in Washington, everybody in the country had to accept this as money or they would go to prison,
mm-hmm.
which is the relationship they have with the Federal Reserve banks. They create this money, and you must accept it or you go to prison. If I could do that, and it's $1,000, and I can give it to you, I'd say, well, Derek, I'll give this money to you, but I want you to give me another piece of paper that says you owe me $1,000, and if you don't pay it, I can come and take your house. Well, this is what banks do all the time. They create money out of nothing, just like that. They do it in the form of loans, credits against your checking account, and then you can write checks on it. But basically, it's the same as writing a piece of paper and signing it. And you'd say, well, this is the way it's done in America and the rest of the world. So, yeah, you give me the $1,000. Well, maybe your home. I'm going to short sell your home a little bit. Let's make it $200,000, okay? Let's make it more realistic. So, and you say, I'll sign a mortgage obligation, a lien on my home for this money that I created out of nothing. Well, I did create it out of nothing, but in this transaction, you backed it by your house. So the money itself really is backed by your house.
Okay.
You created the asset, or you had the asset that gave this money worth. So you see, in a sense, it's the money isn't really created. It's created out of nothing, but in this kind of a transaction, it is backed by something.
It's secured by something.
It's secured by something. Okay, those are secured loans. Now, so much of the world is run on unsecured loans, just credit, promise to pay.
Mm-hmm.
I could say, well, here's $200,000. What have you got to put up as collateral? And you'd say, nothing.
Yeah, I promise.
I promise. And I look at you and say, well, the young guy, he's strong, he's not sick, he's got a good reputation. Other banks have done this before. He's always paid them back. I'll take on the risk, but I'm going to sock you with a lot of interest on it, you see, 18, 22, 24%, because you're not backing it up with anything, and I'm taking a risk.
Yeah, credit card, basically.
Credit card, yeah. That's exactly what it is. So then that's another kind of unsecured risk. And then, of course, the worst kind of all is how the big boys play with Washington, D.C. They go to Uncle Sam and say, what have you got to back up? You want to borrow $1 trillion today? Well, that's fine. We can write $1 trillion as well as we can write $1. It doesn't take much more. And you want to actually borrow $1 trillion, Uncle Sam? You're going to pay us interest on it? You sucker, you? Are you going to do that? And Uncle Sam says, yeah, we have entitlements to pay. We've got a war to fight. We want to have a health care program. You know, we want votes.
Yes.
So they say, yeah, we'd like to do that. So we say to the Uncle Sam, well, what have you got to put up? Uncle Sam, look, he says, do you see that army back there? That's who we have. We will get the money from our taxpayers.
Oh, so we are the collateral, the average taxpayer.
Human beings, the American people, are the collateral.
Wow.
For the loans to the federal government. Uncle Sam is basically saying, we promise to pay back this bond, either to the Federal Reserve or to some investor. Some investor wants to invest $1,000 in U.S. bonds.
Buys a treasury.
Yep. By the treasury. Uncle Sam says, we promise solemnly to promise to pay this back to you plus interest. If we have to take everything from you have to do it, we will do it. So these are rather simple concepts, but they're not taught in school. So people like myself, I come out of school, I've got my diploma on the wall, and I don't know anything about money and the real world of politics. Nothing. You just have to go out and open your eyes and go to Washington and go mingle with some of these high-powered bankers and say, how do you do this? And even read some of their books, and then you find out.
One of the most curious And I want to talk a little bit more about some of our economic issues here in the United States. But there was a news item that I wanted to make sure I asked you about because it struck me as being really curious. Earlier this year, NATO, with the United States in at least a supporting role, some suggest a leading role, began the process of removing Muammar Gaddafi from power in Libya. And it appears that we've reached some sort of a stalemate there. It doesn't look like, unless something remarkable happens, he is going to go, or at least not soon. One of the very first acts of the so-called Transitional National Council in Libya, before they had even gained control over much outside of the city of Benghazi, was to set up its own central bank. And this was a ragtag group of guys driving used pickup trucks to the front lines. Why would they do that? And why would the Western world, including the government of the United States, recognize it and this Transitional National Council as legitimate entities? I mean, why? You'd think their first order of business would be to figure out where their next fuel drop was going to take place. And they set up a bank. Why would they do that?
The obvious answer from my perspective is I don't really know all of their justifications for it, but it's a clue, isn't it? It's a clue. It tells us that, first of all, these guys that are driving these used trucks and all of these mercenaries that are out there running around exchanging gunfire with the Gaddafi's troops, they're not bankers. They know even less than the average American does about banking.
You would think so.
So you know so. And so they're following directives. From whom? Well, who is supporting them? Who is supplying them? Who is funding them? Where does the money come from?
Uh-huh.
Aha. Follow the money, and I think you'll find the answer to that question.
Cui bene? Who benefits?
Yeah, and I think the money trail will take you right to the United States. And I think it'll take you to this thing that I'll be talking about tomorrow, the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're one of the reasons for that whole crisis over there is because they're trying to bring that whole region into this new world order so that each of the pieces fit comfortably. If you get any people like Gaddafi who have some rough edges and they don't fit quite well, maybe they don't want to go along with the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, and they don't want to legitimize all those debts from the United Nations. But they're not fitting very well into this overall pattern of the New World Order. And if that's the case, they have to go. Mm-hmm. So then if they have to go for those reasons, you can't justify that in the world of public opinion by saying, well, we have to get rid of this regime because they're not fitting in with our New World Order plans. You have to convince the world that they're terrorists or something like that.
Hmm. As we record this on July 22nd of 2011, one of the biggest news items here in the United States over the last several weeks has been the looming debt ceiling crisis. We're told that if we don't reach some sort of compromise between the president and Congress by August 2nd, the sky will fall, dogs and cats will live together, whatever. What role does the banking system, the Federal Reserve, play in this? Who stands to gain by whatever compromise they reach? What is the net effect going to be to we American taxpayers and to the global economy?
The first word that gets stuck in my brain with that question is the word compromise. I don't think they're looking for a compromise at all. They're calling it a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
But you either increase the debt or you don't. There's no compromise.
Right.
And the issue really is America capable of taking on more debt or isn't it? Any debt. $1 more, one penny more. That's the real issue. The economy is in the mess it's in my view at least, because of too much debt. If my appraisal is correct, and I think a lot of people agree with that, then the solution is not more debt. So the solution isn't let's compromise and have only half as much more debt as we wanted. No, this is not a compromise at all. The solution is not more debt, but the solution is to get out of debt. However, knowing what we do, the influence that the banks have in both major political parties is so total that there is no way in the world that the parties are going to take a hard stand against increasing the debt. The only question really on the table is, and this is where the word compromise comes in, is it going to be a lot or a little?
Mm-hmm.
So either way, America is doomed.
Hmm.
Because I look at it this way. America is like a dope addict. He's been given so much cocaine over the years, and it's been exhilarating. Man, he's been creative. He's gotten a lot of work done, but now it's all caught up with him. He's exhausted. His health is ruined. He's got the DTs. He's got the shakes. He can't eat. His immune system is down.
Owes money all over town.
Owes money all over town. He's on his way out, and he's lying there in the bed, shivering and shaking, having these illusions. And the doctor comes in and says, maybe we should compromise and give him only half the dose of cocaine that we have been giving him.
Hmm.
If we don't get the patient off of the cocaine habit, the debt habit, the patient will die. That means our economy will die. And nobody wants to say that because we always want to, there has to be a happy answer to this. It has to be an easy way out, right? And the answer is wrong. You've got to bite the bullet. If the system is going to recover, we need a good, we need to detox the system. We need to get rid of all the toxic assets, all the debt, all the corruption. We have to get rid of it. And that, who knows, that may kill the patient too. I mean, we've gone that far. It's not going to be a pretty picture. But if we don't do that, then the patient definitely will not survive.
The idea that our elected leaders are so incompetent or ignorant that we have gotten to this point without any of them realizing that this is where we were headed is difficult for me to accept. I think there has to be an alternate explanation for how we got to this point. And part of it is probably our own fault. I know that we've struggled with some issues of unwise financial choices in the past. But as a nation, we've seen this coming for some time. We've had to. We've known that the debt has been increasing, especially exponentially since the beginning of the George W. Bush administration, and even more so over the last 3 years, 2.5 years of President Obama. I have to ask, is there somebody benefiting from this debt, somebody profiting from holding this debt? Who are they, and will they allow us to get out of debt?
Yes, there are two groups that do profit, and they will not allow us to get out of debt for that reason. And the two groups are the partners in this cabal that I've been talking about. Those are the professional politicians and the international bankers. They have formed a partnership called the Federal Reserve System, or sometimes they call it the United States government. It's become all intertwined now. It's hard to tell where one stops and the other leaves and begins, I should say. But so they're in control, and they benefit because all this money that comes into creation, just take a look at it. The money itself goes into the hands of the bankers, right? It's usually to bail them out.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
They've made all these bad decisions, and so they get the taxpayer to come in and say, don't worry about it. We'll pay off your losses. We're rich. We can do it. And so the bankers benefit, obviously. And by the way, I don't know if people realize it, but so much of that TARP money,
yeah.
These trillions that were created, not just given to American banks but foreign banks as well, everyone's saying, well, why doesn't that get into the economy? Why aren't they lending it out? Why, people still can't borrow money at the banks. Well, of course not. The banks don't want to lend that money out. They've taken much of it and just reinvested it back into the Federal Reserve System, and they're collecting interest on it. They're making money on the savings of the American people. So the bankers benefit. That's one group. And are they going to want to, you know, kill the goose that's laid this golden egg? No. The professional politicians benefit because they get all the money they want for all the political and military schemes they want. They don't even have to go to Congress and ask for it. They just click their fingers, and the Federal Reserve System creates the money and gives it to them. So those are the groups that benefit, and everybody else, mm-hmm. else is hurt by it. And it's as simple as that.
So this is just a massive wealth transfer scheme from the average folk to those who in control of the money system.
It is that.
How does our situation with the debt ceiling differ from the European situation, what they face now with Greece, Portugal, Ireland, who's the other ones? The so-called pigs. Greece, yeah. Spain. But Greece especially is the one that's sort of triggering things right now, and they're facing a crisis and trying to come to some their own compromise. How is their situation different?
I'm not sure that it is different fundamentally, but strategically it's a little different in that with the American debt, the dollar, even though it's in trouble around the world, is still pretty much recognized and sought after. Not as much as it used to be, but people still will grub for an American dollar. In many parts of the world, they still use the dollar. So as long as we can create dollars, we can buy anything we want in the world, you know. Greece can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants a Greek dollar, you know? So it's a strategic problem. That's one of the reasons that the euro has been so important to these Europeans, because they wanted to create a euro that would have the same kind of status and solidity and power that the American dollar does, mm-hmm. so that all they got to do then is just create more euros.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they ain't at that spot yet.
Mm-hmm.
See? So that's why it's all coming back to the United States. All that European debt is somehow washing up onto the American shores in addition to our own debt, because we're the only place in the world that still has that fantastic money-making machine called mm-hmm. the Federal Reserve System.
Mm-hmm.
But that game cannot go on much longer.
Well, I guess the question then, to bring it back around to how this affects you and me, our families, our children, our grandchildren, what do we do? Is there anything we can do to protect ourselves in some small way?
There is plenty that we can do in a small way and in the short term. The obvious things that everybody talks about, you get out of debt, mm-hmm. consumer debt especially.
Yeah.
Debt is not bad if it's for a constructive purpose, if a business venture or something like that. But consumer debt to get a new car, a new TV set, something like that, it's insane. If we have any wealth that's left over, we want to save it, we should certainly put that into gold or silver, I think, because anything denominated in U.S. dollars is being devalued by the minute, by the mm-hmm. hour. You know, every day it goes down and down and down in value. And things like that, I think people should have a supply of food, you know, and all of that. And but that's a short-term solution, because if the system goes kaput, if the patient dies, if the country dies economically, then there's nothing that we will have done that can really save us, because those who might have a little gold or silver put aside would probably be pointed at and say, you're the source of the problem. You were the hoarders. You didn't share. Oh, it happens in all countries that go down. Those that manage to protect themselves are the first ones hauled out of their homes and beaten to death.
Sure, sure.
And because the regime says that they are the ones that caused it. So this is pretty grim stuff, but it's also reality. And I think it tells us that when we talk in terms of what to do about it, we should not stop at the short term and the immediate. We should always think in the terms of the long view. How can we bring the system back to life or rebuild it in some way? And I've spent a major portion of my life in the last 10 years dealing with that issue, and that's the reason we created something called Freedom Force International. Now, I know that's not our topic, but
Go ahead and talk about that. Sure.
Well, it's a plan. It's an organization, first of all. We have people in, 68 different countries now, all of whom have this vision of rebuilding a system, recapturing control of the political destinies of the countries in which we live, instead of always being on the outside of power, saying, oh, please, won't you follow the Constitution? Won't you do what is right? Writing letters and carrying signs and petitions and all that stuff. We understand that the only way to fight this power that has grabbed hold of our respective governments is to have power ourselves and get into those governments and grapple with these people politically, economically, philosophically, and replace them. We must bring the concept of freedom to power instead of the concept of tyranny to power. And it's easier said than done.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a creed. We have to know what we believe in. We have to have strategies and tactics. And all of those things are a major portion of Freedom Force International. So I just would say that anybody that really is interested in the long view of history, by all means, they should come to our website. It's freedomforceinternational.org. And I think they're going to like what they see.
FreedomForceInternational.org, and
right.
Your website is gedwardgriffin.com.
Well, no, our commercial site where we sell books and video mm-hmm. recordings and so forth is called The Reality Zone.
The Reality Zone.
Yeah, realityzone.com.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we'll direct people there. Of course, find a copy and read a copy of The Creature from Jekyll Island, one of the topics that Ed Griffin is talking about here this weekend, and it's been an informative time and an educational time. Perhaps not uplifting,
no,
but
it is reality.
It is reality, and I think we're all better served if we're making decisions based on reality instead of the perceived reality, the illusion of reality that is fed to us through the major media. An honor and a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you so much.
From the Future Congress on Emerging Threats and Challenges, I'm Derek Gilbert.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content, copyright Gilbert House, and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon. Get us out of here. Don't let the hard times get you down. Older days will disappear. There's a new day coming. A new day coming down. There's a new day coming. Oh. Forget about the former days and living in the past.